14,000 followers in just a year. Imagine where she could go next. Reba and Mike have since divorced, but the porn bot is still there. That's loyalty. She had included hashtag Lou with a view in her photograph caption. She had taken the photo while sitting on the loo, and you could just see the tips of her knees in the bottom of the shot. It got 4 likes, Mike and the porn bot being the only dissenters. Early signs there that Mike was not to be relied upon. It soon trailed off into the vast forgotten ocean of Instagram posts that fortunate future historians will spend whole careers interpreting. A few weeks later, the paint started peeling a little. She'd bought the wrong sort. It was only a bit of fun. So she scraped it off. She briefly experimented with hanging a picture of Harry Styles on the door, but again, it seemed disrespectful to him, and what if, unlikely, Bonnie knew, he ever came round? His car broke down on her street, say, and he needed the toilet. The train is now pulling into Letchworth Garden City. Bonnie is a little nervous, but nothing ventured, nothing gained. It was Reba, really, who planted the idea. 14,000 followers, that makes you an influencer. She had Reba to thank for the whole thing. It was Reba who had posted Bonnie's photo on Facebook in the Bathroom Inspiration group, where it had been seen by a woman who had turned out to be Fern Cotton's mum. So then Fern Cotton had seen it and had posted it on her own Instagram with the hashtags hashtag I love my Lou too, hashtag love this idea, hashtag go Bonnie in her caption. The followers started flooding in, but after they liked the toilet door post, there was nothing else for them to see, other than a photograph of Bonnie's lunch that day, a tuna bake. They soon started flooding away again. So, as a stopgap, Bonnie had painted I love my kitchen on one of her kitchen cabinets. Pink again. She had a bit of the paint left. The photo seemed to please the hordes. Love this idea, so fresh. Makes you think about kitchens, like, what are they? Thanks for the inspo. And so Bonnie then painted on her living room wall, her bedroom wall, and the spare bedroom wall, realising after she had finished that she had run out of rooms. The walk from Letchworth Garden City Station to the High Street is surprisingly pleasant. Bonnie sits on a bench and takes out her phone. She unpeels one of her stickers, £4.99 for a roll of 60, direct from her website, which reads, I love my blank. She writes the word bench with a pink glitter pen, £6.99 for 6, direct from her website, and sticks it on the bench. She then takes a photo of herself on the bench next to the sticker and pulls a mildly bemused face as if to say, wait, I love a bench. I might be a little crazy. Applies a few filters, adds hashtag love in Letchworth and hashtag benches need love too, and posts it. As she sets off to meet Felicity, she feels her phone buzz with notifications as people like the post. That gives her some confidence. She knows it's silly, really, but she also knows that she spreads a tiny bit of happiness in a world that needs all the happiness it can find. Who knows what advice Felicity Wollaston might have for her? The stickers and the pens and the paint sets and the stencils are all well and good, but she barely covers her costs. She certainly couldn't give up her job. Maybe Felicity can change all that, elevate her to the next level. Bonnie has plenty of ideas, but she knows that Felicity is the expert. And above all, Bonnie knows you have to dream your dream and see where it takes you. Chapter 29. Amy is still driving.
Will I like him? Asks Rosie. Your father-in-law.
Is he rugged?
Do you like the type of man who eats all his meals in his local pub? Asks Amy. And looks like a roadie for Iron Maiden.
Well, you're hot, which means that you probably married a hot guy, and hot guys usually have hot dads.
So I like my chances.
No touching, says Amy.
I mean it.
The heart wants what it wants, Amy, says Rosie. I'm often powerless.
Has Amy done the right thing involving Steve? It's a good question. She goes through her 6-point checklist. Jeff had drummed it into her during her training. Point 1. assess the situation. The situation is that it seems that Francois Loubet is trying to murder her. That's Jeff's understanding of the situation, and she is almost certainly being implicated in three murders she hasn't committed with no idea why. Point two, assess your strengths. Her strengths are 10 years in the field, a bag containing 100 grand in cash, safe harbour with an 80-year-old woman named Barbara, and a window of 2 or 3 days in which to investigate the murders. Also, implicate her in these killings all you like, but there's no way anyone could ever tie a single one to her. She might have been nearby, but there is no direct evidence anywhere. Three, assess your weaknesses. Her weaknesses are a complete lack of experience in murder investigation, Loubet wanting her dead, and Jeff Nolan possibly having been murdered. Add to these an indeterminately aged woman in a rhinestone jumpsuit who might be shot by a Russian billionaire at any moment, or who might try to seduce her father-in-law. Four, can you build on your strengths? Yes, calling Steve was doing precisely that. He's a man she can trust and a man who can investigate, albeit a man who phoned her from an airport runway in Hampshire to ask how much it might cost to use his mobile phone in America and, when she had no immediate answer, switched his phone off and hasn't been contactable since. Five, can you control your weaknesses? No such luck. Rosie is smoking a cigarette with mischief in her eyes. And point six, act decisively, which she is doing. Amy is not a dweller on things. She tends to concentrate on what is right in front of her at any given time. Someone is killing clients, and perhaps that same someone is framing her for it. Again, if she can't kick it or hit it, it's not particularly in Amy's area of speciality. But right now, Amy's best protection is to investigate and to try to solve the murders of Andrew Fairbanks, Bella Sanchez, and Mark Gooch. She needs to sit down with Steve and talk it all through. Well, she'll talk it all through, he'll nod and listen, and then he'll suggest what they might do. Perhaps she should have cleared all this with Adam before inviting his dad to join a slightly perilous murder investigation 4,000 miles from home. She texts him with voice activation. Ads, might ask your dad for a bit of advice, work stuff, okay by you? That should cover it. The key with Adam is to make him feel part of whatever's going on. He's just flown from Macau to Singapore to broker a lucrative deal between two companies that don't seem to own anything or make anything, but that are, nevertheless, worth billions each. Adam tries to explain sometimes, but really, so long as he's enjoying himself, Amy is happy. The disembodied voice of Siri reads his reply. That'll be nice for him, Ames. He likes to feel involved. Love you to the moon and back. XXX. Amy smiles. She loves Adam to the moon and back too, and decides she should tell him. Same. She is a romantic fool sometimes. Another ping. Steve has finally turned his phone back on. Siri gets to work again. Have landed. No crisps on flight, but we made the most of what we had. Might be a while getting through customs. Amy knows customs won't be a problem. Checks a cursory at the Emery Executive Airfield. Too many clients with too much to hide. Steve will be waved through, unless he attempts to joke with the border official, which she wouldn't put past him. But all things being well, he should be with them soon. She voice messages back. Get the car to take you to the Eternal Glade Wellness Retreat Resort near Greenville. Ask for Barbara Elliott. Another message from Steve. Do you know where the toilet is at the airport? I didn't go on the plane because it was so small and I was worried Brad might hear. Amy shakes her head at this message and then glances over at Rosie, who is somehow simultaneously singing, smoking a cigarette and flipping the bird at a truck driver as they speed past him. Amy has 4 murders to solve, with just Rosie D'Antonio and her father-in-law, Steve, to help her. She gives a little smile, finding that she actually rather likes those odds. Her old friend Adrenaline has returned. Chapter 30. Rob Kenner, murder broker, knows exactly who to call. He always knows exactly who to call. That's the job. The key here, despite Liu Bei's email, is not to panic. The ex-Navy SEAL, Kevin, has messed up. And there was a local cop who had done a nice job of killing the sheriff, but a very bad job of shooting a fleeing Amy Wheeler. He needs someone new. He presses the call button on his Zoom. It's not actually Zoom. It's a heavily encrypted video conferencing app he bought from a Russian at the Emirates Squash Club. It's called Shh. Rob is calling home. London. Very specifically, East London, where he grew up. A place where he knows he'll find someone he can trust. And there, speak of the devil, is Eddie Flood himself, looming into frame and looking for the camera. He's still fit, is Eddie. Hair nicely cropped. Gone to fat a bit, but not as much as the other lads they'd grown up with. Eddie was always a little smarter than the rest.
Eddie, you're looking well, says Rob.
You too, brother. Been too long, says Eddie. Rob looks behind Eddie.
Nice dartboard. I'd kill for a game.
Eddie looks surprised. You not got one?
They don't do darts out here, says Rob.
They do polo. But it's not the same, is it? Polo, says Eddie.
Nah, it's not the same as darts.
Had you fancy a trip to America, Eddie? Rob asks. To business now, no more time to waste.
America? Not much, says Eddie.
We're not having a gossip first.
No time, says Rob.
How are you doing for money?
Badly, says Eddie. You?
Good, thanks, says Rob.
How about 30 grand to kill someone for me? Half now, half when it's done.
Eddie considers this. Does it have to be in America?
Afraid so, old son.
Eddie puffs out his cheeks.
Why me? I trust you, he says. The woman I need you to kill is a piece of work. I need someone good.
You still do the odd job?
Now and then, says Eddie. Course you do, says Rob.
This is all part of the business. Rob hires the right person for the job. Rob gets paid, and Rob doesn't get killed by François Liu Bei. The circle of life.
I don't know, though, says Eddie now, shaking his massive head.
America, a woman?
Yeah, but 30 grand, Eddie. And I need the best.
Yeah, agrees Eddie.
I suppose so.
Rob holds up a photo to the camera. Two women, taken a couple of hours ago. You kill the young one, Amy Wheeler.
What if I have to kill the older one? Asks Eddie.
Don't, he says. She's famous and we don't need the attention. She's Rosie D'Antonio. Rob sees Eddie look away from the camera, trying to hide something in his eyes.
Rosie D'Antonio?
The writer, yeah, says Rob.
You all right there? Look like you've seen a ghost.
Right as rain, says Eddie, seemingly fully recovered from whatever that was.
When do I go?
Now, he says. For reasons we don't have the time to talk about, I need this done quickly. City airport as soon as you can. Use my plane.
You got a plane now?
Two. One in Dubai, one in London. Eddie nods and looks around at the golden decor behind Rob.
Two planes and no dartboards. Times change, eh?
They do, Eddie, old son. They do. Eddie will get the job done. Rob knows that. No flash. No ego. Not like that dumb Navy SEAL, Kevin. Just in, bang, bang, out. Then Rob can stop worrying about François Liu Bei. And that's why old friends are so important. Chapter 31. Steve Wheeler stands at the top of the steps leading down from the private jet. He has drunk probably the equivalent of 6 pints, and the onboard chef had fashioned him a rudimentary steak bake from veal, wagyu beef, and panko breadcrumbs. The moment the hatch opens, the humid South Carolina air hits him like the breath of an angry beast. He probably shouldn't be wearing a denim jacket and a sweatshirt, but that's what he always wears, and America will have to change before Steve does. The sky is the blue of a dream. He is no longer in England. And that thought makes him want to turn back immediately. He's sure they will fly him back home again if he asks politely. On the horizon, he sees a freeway, speeding cars glinting and metallic in a way familiar from films but alien to Hampshire. Also, the freeway signs are the wrong colour. And why does he have the word freeway in his head? It's a motorway, Steve. Don't get sucked in. The adverts on the side of the small private terminal building seem so tantalisingly similar to adverts he might see at home. And yet the teeth are whiter, the hair shinier, and the slogans more sure of themselves. Steve runs a hand through his hair, touches his teeth with his tongue, and feels considerably less confident than he has done in a long time. What will they make of him here? Brad, the flight attendant, stands behind him, swaying slightly, in the manner of a man unused to drinking a great deal of beer at altitude.
You might want to put on your sunglasses, Brad suggests. I don't have sunglasses, says Steve. I'm not a male model.
A hat, then, says Brad. A hat, at least.
I don't have a hat, says Steve.
Who has hats at their beck and call?
Perhaps we should just turn round and head back. Can we do that?
Sure, says Brad.
Depends if you came here to do anything important.
That's annoying. He did come here to do something important. He came here to help Amy, though Lord alone knows how. The very idea that Amy might need any sort of help seems ridiculous to Steve. Amy was made of steel from the day they met, and for the last 5 years, she has been the helper. They don't really talk about anything, Steve and Amy, in their daily chats. Steve is not a lonely man, no, not that. Think of his friends in the village. There's always someone there, someone to have a pint with. So she isn't there to stop him feeling lonely. So what is it that Amy does when they chat about nothing? They certainly don't talk about grief. There are other people to talk to about that if he ever felt the need. Margaret from next door lost her father not so long ago. Tony Taylor from the pub, his wife left him. And there are online forums if things get bad. The police offer a grief counselling service to former officers, but he'd be laughed out of town if he took them up on that sort of thing. Resilience is an underrated quality in Steve's mind, and so grief counselling was never for him. He often explains this to Amy on their calls, talks through why he doesn't need grief counselling, why he can handle it himself, why grief is private. Amy is very good about it, to be fair, never presses the point. They just have a good old chat about their days instead. Maybe talk about Debbie for a bit, and sometimes Amy will tell a funny story she has remembered about her. Yep, plenty of people bang on about grief counselling, but Amy isn't one of them. She respects his opinion, Steve reckons, knows he doesn't need it. So they'll laugh and cry about all sorts of things, the two of them, but no one ever mentions grief. He descends the steps. Welcome to America. There will be another car to meet him, he knows that. Amy has arranged it all. But the car will have to wait, because Steve needs a little snoop around the airport first. This was where Andrew Fairbanks arrived, wasn't it? Where he was picked up by some mystery man. Steve feels like there is something here that he could usefully look into, some actual investigating. This way, he arrives with a present. Brad is removing Steve's luggage from the hold of the jet. His camping rucksack, the bottom held together by duct tape. Everything in this place, the plane, the staff, the terminal, the grass, the lights, everything is gleaming and sparkling and at the top of its game. Everything, that is, except for Steve's rucksack. And for Steve himself. Ragged and baggy, but does the job. Steve refuses to let Brad carry the rucksack to the terminal. Can you imagine? Brad, ever the professional, looks a little put out, though he also looks like a man for whom beer and Parmesan croutons don't mix. What's in the building? Steve asks. Passport control, all that?
Your passport will be checked in the arrival suite, says Brad. Then border security.
They never check bags, though. Steve is relieved. He doesn't need a bored man with a gun questioning why he's only packed 3 pairs of underpants. Many staff?
I'm afraid I don't have that information, says Brad. But it's a small airport.
So everyone will know everything, says Steve.
Brad doesn't understand the question, but nods regardless. Sliding doors open in front of them, and the air conditioning instantly transforms Steve's pools of uncomfortable hot sweat into pools of uncomfortable cold sweat. He feels like he is growing stalactites. He follows the sign that says, Arrival Suite. US Customs and Border Protection welcomes you. A hefty man in a blue uniform and aviator shades holds out his massive hand for Steve's passport. The name on his gold badge says, Carlos Moss.
Purpose of travel, sir,
says Carlos Moss, as Steve rummages around in his rucksack. Family visit, says Steve, eyeing the man's gun. After 25 years on the force, there are very few fellow officers he would have trusted with a gun. It looks good on Carlos Moss, though.
I'm in the job too, says Steve.
25 years in the police. Private investigator now. I'm Customs and Border Protection, sir, says Carlos, unimpressed. That's a different job.
For sure, says Steve, seeing his awkward frame reflected in the sunglasses. For sure, but, you know, hunting down the bad guys, right? That's what we do.
And bad women, says the man. Don't profile, please. What family are you visiting, sir?
Daughter-in-law, says Steve. I'd love, man-to-man here, to take a look around. See your systems? The CCTV, you know? I'd get a kick out of that, as a professional.
Carlos looks down at Steve and lowers his aviator shades for the first time.
Sir, are you on drugs?
No, says Steve.
Okay, plan B then. Steve nods at the man's gun.
You ever shoot that?
Sir?
Your gun, says Steve, finally finding his passport and handing it over.
Can't imagine you get a lot of trouble here.
Sir, says the man, flicking through Steve's passport and looking at him again. I hope you don't think we're having a conversation.
No, says Steve.
No, apologies. Just, this would be an easy airport to smuggle a gun into. Everything a bit lax. No real cops.
That should do it, surely. He just needs to get inside the security hub.
This your bag?
Carlos Moss motions to Steve's rucksack. The bag I just carried all the way from the plane and pulled my passport out of, says Steve.
Yes, it's my bag, Sherlock.
Bit much?
Is that humour, sir? I hope not.
Long flight, says Steve. Also, I'm English.
Also, stupid question, Carlos.
Carlos lowers his aviator shades once more.
Sir, you've made me lower my sunglasses 2 times now. That's plenty enough. You want me to search this bag? You want to see the parts of this airport that ain't so pretty?
That's exactly what Steve wants. At any regular US airport, he would have been in a back room after his first remark, but they have obviously been told not to cause a fuss here. No wonder rich people got away with so much. So he might need one more push. If I'd packed a gun, you wouldn't find it, however hard you searched.
Sir?
You'd never find it, says Steve. It's the American mindset, too obvious. Steve already thought that Carlos Moss was tall, but he now uncoils himself further. Carlos finally takes off his shades.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to accompany me for a full search.
Bingo, thinks Steve, job done. He then wonders exactly what his plan is now. Whatever it is, he hopes he'll figure it out before the man pulls on a latex glove. Carlos leads Steve to exactly the spot he had hoped for, the bit of the airport that the tourists never see, unless that tourist has a suitcase full of cocaine or some such. Carlos swings Steve's bag onto a metal table and starts undoing the flimsy clasps.
Sir, what exactly is your business in the United States?
Carlos has begun delving into Steve's luggage.
You pack light, sir. How long are you staying?
Not long, hopefully, says Steve.
Not that this isn't a lovely place to be, but there's the quiz on Wednesday, and Margaret's very good with trouble, but
he misses me.
Trouble?
My cat, says Steve.
You're a cat guy,
says Carlos, nodding. He spends a moment or two looking Steve up and down.
What sort of a cat?
Rescued stray, says Steve.
Good, says Carlos,
pulling a Van Halen t-shirt out of Steve's bag.
You a Halen fan?
Greatest band of all time, says Steve.
You've got that right, sir,
says Carlos. Call me Steve, says Steve. Carlos shakes his head.
No, sir. So why are you here?
Have you heard of a man called Andrew Fairbanks? Asks Steve.
Can't say I have.
Carlos now pulls a Def Leppard t-shirt from Steve's rucksack and nods approvingly.
Two t-shirts for the whole trip?
Should do it, don't you think? Says Steve. And you have washing machines over here. Andrew Fairbanks is the guy who died on the yacht.
Tied him to a rope and the sharks got him?
That's the fella, says Steve. Carlos is repacking his rucksack, much neater than Steve had done. Can I show you a photo of him?
Carlos tightens the drawstring at the top of Steve's bag. Sir?
Steve.
Sir, you are subject to a search by Customs and Border Protection. I'm within my rights to demand silence from you, but seeing as you love cats, and you understand where Van Halen sits in the scheme of things, I've given you a little leeway. But you're in no position to be showing me photos, except the one on your passport, where you look a lot more respectable than the guy standing in front of me.
Steve gives his passport photo a peek. My wife made me dress up, have a haircut.
Your wife traveling with you?
She's dead, says Steve. She died.
Sorry to hear that, says Carlos. I know what that feels like. So you're here to visit your daughter-in-law?
Amy, says Steve. You'd love her.
I'm sure, says Carlos. The two of you got plans?
If I say investigating a murder, will you send me back to England?
You armed? Asks Carlos.
No, says Steve.
I'd recommend it, says Carlos. What murder? Andrew Fairbanks.
Are you interested in that? Steve asks.
I'm interested in a lot of things, says Carlos. Orchids?
He used this airport, you know, says Steve.
Did he now? Carlos replies.
On Tuesday, says Steve. Were you here?
Day off. I was at an airship show, says Carlos. I like blimps.
Steve loves airships, but maybe that's for another time. Focus now. A driver picked up Fairbanks at the airport, but no one knows who. Has anyone been asking?
Not as far as I know, says Carlos. Just you.
Local police?
Not a soul, says Carlos.
Would be fun to look at your CCTV, wouldn't it? Says Steve. See what we can see? Perhaps whoever picked him up killed him.
I have another flight landing in 20 minutes, sir.
Steve. Take it to the cops. Steve, says Carlos.
You're not curious? Steve asks. I'll be curious about whether you're smuggling drugs in your back passage if you don't let this go, says Carlos.
I'll tell you what I'll do, says Steve. He pulls his Ponies of the New Forest notebook from his bag. I'm going to write down the name of the greatest ever Van Halen song in this notebook. You do the same in your notebook. And if we both choose the same track, you let me take a look at the CCTV, which you're dying to look at anyway. Steve starts to write and then hands his pen to Carlos. Carlos hesitates, but Steve knows that most people find it impossible to resist the opportunity to voice their opinion on this sort of thing. He also knows that Carlos is going to choose Unchained. He can read him. Carlos sighs, pulls his small notebook from his shirt pocket and starts writing. Got him. Carlos finishes writing and hands back the pen. Steve opens his notebook, places it on the table, and spins it to face Carlos. There, in capital letters, is Unchained. Carlos nods and places his notebook on the table too. He spins it, and then he opens it. It reads, When It's Love. Steve looks at the name, then at Carlos. Come on, man.
I like the gentler stuff, says Carlos. Sorry, Steve. Now, if you don't mind, I've got some more billionaires to pretend to frisk.
The door to the security office swings open, and a young woman pokes her head into the room.
The Cessna from London's delayed by an hour. Why don't you take your break, Carlos?
Sure, ma'am, says Carlos.
Y'all done here?
She asks, looking at Steve and his bag.
Pretty much, says Carlos. Few more questions and I'll have this gentleman on his way.
The woman disappears again.
Okay, Steve, says Carlos. I'll give you 20 minutes with the CCTV, but you have to fill me in on everything.
In every investigation, there is a first step, a little toehold to start you on the climb ahead. François Loubet, Joe Blow, Letchworth Garden City. It's all in there somewhere. Chapter 32.
In the boardroom of Maximum Impact Solutions, Susan Knox, Jeff's right-hand woman and head of HR, is looking through Jeff's file on François Loubet. Bloomberg News is on the conference room TV. They are bemoaning the stubborn problem of high interest rates. There must be a clue in here somewhere. Susan has no idea if Jeff is alive or dead. If anyone else's car had been found riddled with bullet holes and soaked in their own blood, you could be fairly sure they were a goner. But Jeff? She tries his numbers constantly. Jeff has so many phones, but at the moment she is getting zero response from any of them. Susan Knox has also accessed a few of Jeff's bank accounts. He has many different accounts for many different purposes, from a high-yield tax-free interest account in the Cayman Islands to the NatWest account his granddad started for him with £5 nearly 40 years ago. That account's got more than £5 in it now. Susan looks at the balance, something just over £2 million. But more importantly, she looks at recent transactions. Nothing, except for his regular payments, gas, broadband, £5,000 a month to save the children. The most recent transaction is for fuel at a petrol station in South London several days ago. In account after account, she finds the same pattern. Balances in the millions, recent transactions, none. The two accounts she is most familiar with are empty, but they have been for a while, so no clues there either. So if Jeff is alive, he isn't using his phones, and he isn't spending his money. Though he will have phones and money hidden away somewhere, surely. With Jeff absent, missing, presumed neither alive nor dead but pending, who can she turn to? Most of the work at Maximum Impact Solutions is done by freelancers out in the field, and the office is deathly quiet this late. Her old boss, Henk, Jeff's best friend for so many years, surely he would help out if Jeff has been killed. She continues reading Loubet's emails to Jeff. They become increasingly threatening, yet they're all written in that strangely jolly tone of his. Who is this man? There must be something that gives him away. A turn of phrase, anything. Throughout the file are little scribbled question marks. Clearly Jeff has tried to do what she is trying to do right now. Work out the identity of François Loubet. There is also a row of question marks next to the reference to Joe Blow. The last two pages of the file are François Loubet's client identity form. It is laughably brief. Loubet's name, the name of an Indonesian bank, and blank boxes. She has been through the whole file. The man is a ghost. There is nothing here she can use to identify Loubet, and nothing that will help to identify Joe Blow. What to do next? She can't talk to Jeff. Susan looks at the boardroom mirror that hides Henk's secret den. She's not 100% sure she should trust Henk Van Veen either. But does she have a better option? Amy Wheeler? As Bloomberg News continues to chatter behind her, Susan decides that Amy has to be worth a shot. Somebody else needs to read these files before anybody else dies. Chapter 33.
I want you to think about your fears.
Amy rolls her eyes. Rosie whispers to her. If you don't take this seriously, I'm going to hand you in to the police or the people trying to kill you. They are sitting cross-legged in a small clearing in a woodland at the Eternal Glade Wellness Retreat. In front of them, Barb is banging a small gong and, from time to time, humming. Night lights twinkle on the deck.
Think about what your fears represent, says Bob. How your fears might help you, how your fears might control you. Greet them, sit with them, break bread with those fears.
Amy wonders when Steve might arrive. Soon, she hopes. There is plenty of work to do. They need to go through the printouts from Sheriff Scroggie's computer. She has been reading them, but is yet to find the smoking gun. There is no doubt that Scroggie killed Andrew Fairbanks on the boat, but is there anything in Scroggie's papers that could lead them directly to François Loubet?
Rosie, says Bob, can you feel the vibrations of the gong?
Do you know? I think I can, Barb, says Rosie. Amy knows it is important for Rosie to enter into the spirit of the thing. Barb is putting them up at the retreat, after all.
Don't call me Barb, says Bob, banging the gong once again.
Sorry, Barb, says Rosie. What was it again?
Grey Panther, says Bob.
Okay, says Rosie. Why not Silver Panther? Wouldn't that be cooler? Bob looks at Rosie, the wisdom and serenity departing her face for a brief moment.
I didn't think of it. No matter. I want you both.
You could change it now, Amy suggests. She's worried that she's been a bit quiet and that Bob might be offended. We can just call you Silver Panther.
I'm afraid you must be known by whichever spirit calls you, says Bob. And besides, it's on all my business cards, so too late.
Amy hasn't yet got to the bottom of how Rosie and Bob know each other. Bob is in her 80s and looks it in a comfortable, well-earned way. Surely Rosie isn't 80, too. Amy sneaks a peek. I mean, possibly? With a lot of work. Was Bob also an author at some point? A rival turned friend? Perhaps an editor?
I want you to name your fears, Rosie, Bob continues. Give them wings and let them fly among us.
Amy sees Rosie close her eyes.
I fear mental and physical decline, says Rosie. I fear the loss of friends and loves.
Bob bangs the gong after each fear.
I fear being misunderstood, says Rosie, of being seen as an inconsequential person, a joke. I fear being forgotten. I fear being remembered for hair and lipstick and leopard print and sunglasses, and not for what I worked for and what I am proud of.
The gong continues. Amy wonders if this is what therapy is like.
I fear connection, says Rosie, and I fear a lack of connection. I fear that perhaps I am not real, that I have been imagined as so many things by so many people that my soul is now in them and no longer in myself.
It occurs to Amy that Bob will be asking her the same question in a matter of moments, so she'd better start thinking. What does she fear? Amy feels like she got all her fears out of the way in childhood. If the worst possible things have happened to you already, what can the world do to you? Rosie is still releasing her many fears into the world.
I fear that people see the mask and not the face, continues Rosie. I fear that I will forget the little girl I once was many years ago.
How many years ago, though? Thinks Amy.
I fear being small, says Rosie, being vulnerable, being powerless. I refuse to fear death, but I do fear life.
Rosie keeps her eyes closed for a few more moments, then breathes in slowly and opens them. Amy sees tears that are refusing to fall.
Thank you, Rosie, says Bob, for your honesty, for your bravery, and for your wisdom.
Bob turns to Amy, as Amy had known she would.
Amy, says Bob with a light gong bang. You are welcome here, and you are valued here.
Thank you, Grey Panther, says Amy. Very much not for her, any of this, but needs must.
Amy, I want you to name your fears, says Bob. Give them wings and let them fly among us.
Amy closes her eyes, as Rosie had done.
I fear,
starts Amy, wanting to be as truthful as she possibly can. She dives as deeply as she is able into the blackness of her mind, into the void she knows is always there, but that she carefully steps around. It's funny, she and Steve never talk about her childhood. He knows she doesn't need to, and he knows the importance of resilience. They just chat about nothing instead. He tells her how much he loves her and how special she is, how they are family. But they never have to talk about her childhood. Down and down Amy goes, searching for a fear, searching for the thing that scares her the most. She finds it. "I fear," Amy says, and stops. She takes her time, as she has never acknowledged this before. "Spiders." Amy waits a few seconds, breathes out and opens her eyes. "Thank you, it felt good to admit that. It's the way they move, I think." Barb looks at her for a moment and then, in Amy's opinion, a little sarcastically, bangs the gong. There is a rustling in the trees ahead of them and Amy pulls her gun. She nods at Rosie to get behind her.
"I'm not going to take orders from someone who's afraid of spiders," says Rosie.
"And strictly speaking, it's no guns here," says Barb.
A figure emerges from the trees, a figure wearing a Van Halen t-shirt and carrying a small rucksack. Amy rushes towards him and hugs him, careful to point the gun away from his neck as she does.
"You made it."
"Car was waiting at the airport," says Steve.
Rosie D'Antonio has somehow crept up on him without making a single sound. She extends a hand.
"Well, you must be Steve," she says.
He takes her hand.
"Pleasure to meet you, Rosie."
"The pleasure is mine, I assure you," says Rosie, holding on to Steve's hand for longer than Amy is comfortable with.
"That's quite a grip you have."
"Put him down, Rosie," says Amy. Rosie lets go of Steve's hand, but maintains eye contact.
"I don't suppose you ride a motorbike, Steve."
"A motorbike?" says Steve.
"No."
"Oh, you should," says Rosie. "It would suit you."
"She's scared of life, apparently," Amy says to Steve. "Wouldn't know it, would you? Do you need rest or are you ready to work? I've got a million files for you."
"I'm ready," says Steve.
"And I come bearing gifts."
He takes a sheet of paper from his rucksack and shows it to Amy and Rosie. "CCTV from the airport," says Steve. "Shows Andrew Fairbanks being picked up." In the image, Andrew Fairbanks is greeted, then led away by a slim woman with long red hair tied in a ponytail. Fairbanks carries one of his suitcases, and the woman, despite being half his size, carries the other, a leather holdall.
"How did you get this?" Rosie asks.
"Airships and Van Halen," says Steve.
"I've ridden both in my time," says Rosie.
"I think that might be our cue to do some work," says Amy. "You get anything from Scroggy?" Steve asks. "The sheriff?"
"His corpse was hanging from the ceiling," says Amy.
"Ah." Barb approaches the group. "Steve," says Amy, "this is Barb. She's hiding us away from prying eyes."
"You have," says Barb to Steve, "if you don't mind my saying, the eyes of a kind soul."
"She says that to everyone," says Rosie. "Knock it off, Barb."
"That's very kind of you, Barbara," says Steve, as Barb kisses him on both cheeks.
"It's not Barbara," says Barb.
"I see," says Steve. "So where does Barb come from?"
"It's a nickname," says Rosie. "For 30 years, she controlled the barbiturates trade across the entire East Coast."
So that's how Rosie and Barb know each other, thinks Amy. Mystery solved.
And speaking of mysteries, time to get to work. Amy has been backed into corners her whole life, and she learned a long time ago that the only way out of the corner is to fight.
"Someone is trying to kill me," says Amy, "and someone from Maximum Impact is helping them, so let's shoot some people until we find out who."
Steve nods.
"Or gather some clues, sure.
And then shooting," says Amy.
"We'll see," says Steve, "we'll see."
It really is nice to have him here. Chapter 34. Eddie Flood exits the plane, steps into the South Carolina humidity and immediately puts on his sunglasses. He texts Rob Kenner. Landed. What is he doing here? Hired to kill a woman for £30,000. That's not all, of course, but he can't tell Rob Kenner everything he's here to do. Rob would kill him if he knew the whole truth. In his suitcase, there are clothes to make him look like a tourist, clothes to make him look like a business traveller, and there are combat fatigues for the job at hand. He also has his laptop, as always. He'd been researching bullets on the flight. Entry wounds, exit wounds. The time flew by. Entering the small terminal building, Eddie sees two customs officers. One is a white guy with a small moustache and a thin mouth. The other a large black guy who stands like a man who can handle himself in a fight. Eddie chooses the black guy. Looks much more his type. As he approaches, he sees the name tag. Carlos Moss.
"Passport, please, sir," says Carlos.
"Beautiful day, Carlos," says Eddie.
"I don't believe we know each other, sir," says Carlos. "Passport, please."
Eddie takes his passport from his jacket and hands it to Carlos.
"Purpose of visit?"
Carlos asks. "Pleasure," says Eddie.
Carlos lowers his aviator shades and looks Eddie in the eye.
No worries for Eddie. He has many faults, but being easily intimidated is not one of them.
"What kind of pleasure, sir?"
Eddie likes where this is going. He needs information, and Carlos seems to be the kind of guy who could help him.
"I heard this is where Rosie D'Antonio lives," says Eddie.
"The author? I'm a big fan."
"That's so," says Carlos.
"She's the best," says Eddie.
"Favorite book, Edward?"
"Too many good ones to choose between," says Eddie. "Call me Eddie, everybody does."
"Everybody but me," says Carlos, and takes a look at Eddie's suitcase. "You pack this suitcase yourself, sir?"
Eddie glances at the other border officer, stamping passports without looking and smiling at passengers.
Yes, says Eddie.
He's very glad he's not carrying a gun. He'll be picking that up at a gas station on something called Route 47 from a man named Duke.
"What's the pay like here, Carlos?"
"Excuse me," says Carlos.
"The pay," repeats Eddie.
He has access to a few expenses. You get treated well.
"Do you have a reason for asking?"
"Just making conversation," says Eddie.
"Then I'd advise you to make it with somebody else," says Carlos.
"Sorry," says Eddie. "Long flight, and I'm English. Bad combination."
"Sir, I meet a lot of people who've been on flights," says Carlos.
"Must do," says Eddie, "must do. I bet she's got a plane somewhere here, hasn't she?"
"Sir?"
"Rosie D'Antonio. Bet she's got a hell of a plane."
"I know you can't tell me that sort of thing, but, you know, maybe you can."
There are a few moments of silence as the two men look at each other.
"Sir, I'm going to ask you to come with me for a moment," says Carlos,
and he takes Eddie's elbow.
"Course, course," says Eddie. "Is something wrong?"
"Just a random check," says Carlos. "Bring your baggage. I'll have you on your way in no time."
Bingo. A quiet back room somewhere. Eddie can bung this Carlos geezer a few hundred dollars.
"Lead the way, Carlos, old son," says Eddie.
"So, Rosie D'Antonio, back and forth all the time, is she?"
"That feels a lot like business, sir," says Carlos. "And none of your business at that."
Carlos opens the door to what looks very much to Eddie like an interrogation room. And Eddie knows what an interrogation room looks like. The key now is to make a connection with Carlos Moss and then seal the deal.
"What kind of music do you like?" Eddie asks.
"As good a start as any."
"Sir, this is a United States port of entry," says Carlos, "not a dating app."
"Big hip-hop fan, myself," says Eddie.
This is a lie, but he is taking a punt. He's a pretty good reader of people. His favourite band is actually Van Halen, but that's not going to fly here.
"I need you to sit here for a moment," says Carlos, and once Eddie has sat down, he walks out of the door and closes it behind him.
And Eddie notes he locks it from the outside. Another sensation he is familiar with. Eddie can authorize a payment of up to $1,000 for information. He'll start with an offer of $300 and work his way up if needs be. He'll settle in for now and wait for Carlos to do whatever he needs to do. He takes out his laptop again. No point wasting time. He's got business to take care of. Chapter 35. Steve has woken up in a treehouse. A tree mansion, really, built into the boughs of a South Carolina elm. One of a series connected by walkways through the forest canopy. The treehouse has a porch with views for many miles. Steve is now reading the documents from Scroggy's computer, spread out on a low bamboo table in front of him. Barb is setting them up for the day ahead.
I could get you a rosehip tea infusion, or a jasmine and honeysuckle, or a clean juice, or an antioxidizing water, says Barb. Rosie is having a cactus smoothie, and your lovely daughter-in-law is having water with agave syrup.
I don't suppose I could have a beer, Steve asks. It would be lunchtime back home.
No alcohol, says Barb. I don't think we need it, do we?
I mean, it's a point of view, says Steve.
In the blazing heat, Steve is now wearing his Def Leppard t-shirt and a pair of blue satin gym shorts Barb has brought him from Lost and Found. He has refused, however, to wear flip-flops. There are lines he will not cross, and so is still wearing combat boots.
No alcohol, no dairy, no meat, says Barb. Clean air, clean living.
And yet you were a major league drug dealer for many years, Barb.
God don't care about yesterday, says Barb. God cares about tomorrow. I'll make you a rosehip infusion, and I'll put a bit of kale in it. But only because you're so handsome.
Steve sees Rosie and Amy crossing the walkway towards him. Time for business. Barb gives him a wink and heads off to get his drink. Amy and Rosie climb onto the porch, and after hugs and greetings, and a number of comments about Steve's shorts, attention is turned to murder. Fairbanks, Sanchez, Gooch, says Amy. All influencers, all flown out to aspirational locations for photo shoots, all shot pretty much the moment they arrive, and all left out on display for the world to see.
And all three killed within an hour or so of where you happen to be, Steve says to Amy.
And all three clients of Maximum Impact, says Rosie.
Two key questions then, says Steve.
Why were they killed? And why were you in the vicinity every time?
I like the way you say vicinity, says Rosie.
Have you found anything in Scroggy's computer records? Asks Amy.
One major thing, says Steve. I don't know what we read into this, but it worried me. When Scroggy is sent his instructions for the murder, he is also sent a blood sample.
A blood sample, says Amy.
Steve nods, and he is asked to leave it at the scene of the killing.
To incriminate someone, says Rosie.
Presumably, says Steve.
Whose blood sample? Amy asks.
Don't say mine. Jesus, don't say mine.
Steve holds up his hands.
No idea.
But is there any way someone could get hold of your blood?
Your mandatory drugs tests? Suggests Rosie.
Every 3 months, says Amy, nodding. They take a sample at Maximum Impact.
And could Lube get hold of that? Steve asks.
I hope to God he couldn't, says Amy.
Chapter 36. Max Highfield, the world's seventh sexiest male, not that the Academy seems to care about that, sits in a huge Winnebago dressed as a Roman centurion. He is reading lines from a thick yellow script opposite a film director. She is wearing headphones around her neck and is also holding a script.
I shall not praise Caesar this day. This victory does not honour him, for there is no honour in sight upon this field. The bloodshed stains his hands, and the bones of children we see scattered around us will bury him. We remember, soldiers, we remember this day as we march on Rome, as we march towards destiny. Death to Caesar!
Max puts the script down.
I think I'll just say, death to Caesar, and do the rest with my eyes.
The director nods and draws some lines through her script. There is a knock on the Winnebago door.
Come,
says Max. A runner enters with a bouquet of flowers.
Just delivered for you.
Max looks at the flowers and returns to his centurion voice.
They please me.
The runner nods, uncertainly. Can I get you a coffee?
A coffee, by my oath, says Max. And think you does a Roman centurion drink coffee, messenger?
I don't know, says the runner. We've got Coke Zero.
I think Roman centurions drank coffee, Max, says the director. It's been around for thousands of years. Grunts Max. Then I shall have a coffee upon your return.
The runner nods. How do you take it?
Soy milk latte, says Max. And hasten.
The runner nods and puts the flowers on a table. As the runner leaves, Max picks up the card that came with the flowers and opens it. It reads, You're dead. Chapter 37.
Jeff could get hold of your blood, though, Rosie says quietly.
It wouldn't be Jeff, says Amy. He's the one who warned me about Lou Bay and about Joe Blow.
Though he did know where you were when all three of them were murdered, says Steve. And he knew where you were when Kevin came calling.
Who else at Maximum Impact might be involved?
Hank Van Veen, says Amy. Left the company 3 months ago. Been stealing clients ever since.
So maybe killing clients as well, suggests Rosie. Scare people away from Maximum Impact.
Where is Hank? Steve asks.
Back in England, as far as I know, says Amy.
But he wouldn't know my movements.
But he could have taken your blood, says Steve, months ago.
And Susan Knox, says Amy. She's Jeff's right-hand woman. She'd know where I was, and she'd know where my blood was.
I think we have to keep moving, says Rosie.
If Amy's blood is at that scene, then
could the police match it to you, though, Amy? Steve asks.
Is your DNA on any database?
Well, I've never been arrested, says Amy.
Another thing Maximum Impact insists on.
But I don't want to take any chances.
If that's my blood at the scene, I want to get as far away from South Carolina as I can.
Come on, let's go to St. Lucia, suggests Rosie. Keep investigating.
I don't know, says Steve, glancing into his treehouse.
I've just unpacked and I'm settled in and I don't...
How long did unpacking take? Amy asks.
It doesn't matter how long it took, says Steve.
If I unpack, I settle. You know that, Amy. I've only just got here.
I think I'd like to go down there, says Amy.
I have to keep moving, so I might as well go somewhere I can be useful. See what we can find out about Bella Sanchez. Was she carrying money too? Was she shot by a local cop for hire?
Did they find blood at the scene? Says Rosie.
Amy nods. At least then I can feel like I'm doing something.
She's right, Stevie, says Rosie.
It's just Steve, says Steve.
You suit Stevie, says Rosie.
What I suit is staying in Hampshire, says Steve.
But you love Amy, so here we are, says Rosie.
Relax into it.
Do you smoke marijuana?
Take a guess, says Amy.
Where I should really be is Letchworth Garden City, says Steve, finding one of his files. Andrew Fairbanks was hired by the Vivid Viral Agency, address Letchworth Garden City. Not the natural home for a hip media company.
I like that you say hip, says Rosie. Takes me back.
He was advertising Crusher Energy Drink, continues Steve, a company also registered at the same address in Letchworth Garden City.
Companies have offices everywhere, says Amy.
Rosie's right. We have to go to St. Lucia.
I'll pack for you.
Steve's phone rings. The display says, Carlos Airship.
Excuse me a second. He takes the call.
Carlos?
You told me to tell you if anyone was asking after Ms. D'Antonio.
Uh-huh.
Steve looks over at Rosie and whispers, Just a friend I met at the airport.
I got a guy in a cell right now asking questions about her.
What sort of guy?
English, named Eddie Flood. Looks like a boxer who gets beaten up a lot. He has the address of a gas station in his bag, and it's the kind of gas station where you can buy more than just gas. I can keep him here for maybe 2 more hours before I get fired.
Carlos, you're a hero, says Steve. You're wrong about Van Halen, but you're a hero.
Back at you, brother. Says Carlos. Talk soon.
Rosie and Amy are both looking at him.
Okay,
says Steve to Rosie and Amy. A development. It looks like a new guy is on his way here to kill Amy.
St. Lucia, then, says Amy. If he's followed us here, he can follow us to St. Lucia, says Steve.
Your hot dad is right, says Rosie. They'll be tracking my plane.
Barb arrives with the drinks. As she places the tray on the table, she looks at the photos Rosie took of Justin Scroggie's dead body. She raises an eyebrow to Rosie, and Rosie raises a finger to her lips. Barb does the same in return. Steve is thinking. Rosie and Amy are right, he knows it. They should go to St. Lucia. That's how you investigate stuff. Perhaps he can get somebody else to take a look at Letchworth Garden City. But how to shake Eddie off their tail? Carlos can't hold him back forever. But there is a way, though. He messages Carlos. Might have a little job for you.
I have a plan, he announces to Amy and Rosie. If it involves Letchworth Garden City, we've heard it, says Amy. Steve shakes his head and takes a sip of his rose hip and kale tea. What is it now, Saturday? Hopefully they can wrap this all up before the quiz night next Wednesday.
Where's your pilot? Steve asks Rosie.
Hilton Head, says Rosie. She does a few tourist trips for the locals while she waits for me to call.
Can you get her to the airport?
Sure, says Rosie. She might take a while to sober up.
Where is she flying?
St. Lucia or Letchworth?
Neither, says Steve.
Chapter 38. Carlos could not be more apologetic. Eddie has to hand it to the guy.
Bureaucracy, man, says Carlos. I'm sorry. When the computer beeps, it beeps.
I get it, says Eddie, folding away his laptop. How long has he been locked in here?
Same the world over.
Tell you the truth, says Carlos. Computer wanted to keep you in for longer. You ever been arrested?
Couple of times, says Eddie. Couple of times. His passport was supposed to have been wiped clean, though. Rob Kenner had assured him.
That'll be it, says Carlos. Knew it as soon as I saw you. Game recognizes game. I had to pull a little magic trick to ease your way through the system.
Eddie knew it. All the talk of hip-hop and money had done the trick. This could have ended very badly for Eddie.
He was lucky he'd chosen to stand in Carlos's queue. Well, a bit of luck, bit of judgment.
He stands and stretches and follows Carlos out of the interrogation room.
I appreciate that, Carlos, says Eddie. Can I call you Carlos? You sure can, brother, says Carlos. And maybe I can make it up to you, this little delay.
You've done enough, says Eddie, as Carlos opens the door leading back to the immigration hall.
It's just you were asking about Rosie D'Antonio, the writer.
Uh-huh, says Eddie. This is suddenly getting very interesting. Perhaps the delay will have been worth it.
Her plane is getting ready to fly.